So the group here today has been is in the Anga. If you want to come closer, you're welcome to. And a few of you are not. So in the Anga, we've been looking at Dogen's essay, Being Time, as the fact of our life. What is it to be a being? What is it to all beings are time? So we've looked through the first two paragraphs that are sort of deep and rich and sort of huge. An ancient Buddha said, being time stands on top of the highest peak. Being time walks on the bottom of the deepest ocean. Being time is three heads and eight arms. Being time is the height of 8 or 16 feet. Being time is a staff or a whisk. Being time is a pillar or a lantern. Being time is the younger suns. Being time is the earth and sky. Let's just say, as we went through, this is Buddhas and demons and you and me and staffs and whisk and ordinary implements and earth and sky. And he went on to say, being time means that time itself is being and all beings are time. The 16-foot golden Buddha is time. Because it is time, it is the radiant illumination of time. Study it as the 24 hours of the present day. The three-headed, eight-armed, wrathful guardians are time. Because of that, they are not different from the 24 hours that are now. And that paragraph is going back forth between some sense of everything is time, and actually time is also 24 hours of the day, and how would you hold those two? Now, what I want to look at today is, after all this kind of large and it's like a largely yeasted lump of dough that has gotten very large and puffy, and we can't really hold it in one hand, and it's kind of flopping around. And we punch down for the next paragraph, and it rose up again. Well, now he sort of switches gears. He's going to talk about your doubt, understanding and doubt. That's the part I want to look at today. Dogen says, we cannot measure how long or short the 24 hours are, or how remote or urgent. Yet we call a day 24 hours. The imprint of time's coming and going is so evident that we do not doubt it. Although we do not doubt it, that does not mean we understand it. When sentient beings do doubt what they fail to understand, since things are not fixed, this moment's doubt can't possibly coincide with the question at the very next moment. Yet doubt itself is nothing but time. So here I have a doubt, and then it's in some way not even relevant anymore because there's a whole new moment has arisen, and so a doubt is not a part. How do you look at something? How can you look at time? How can you, when you're already in it? How can you look at your life when you're already in it? And yet it's the only time and place there is for looking at it. It seemed to me when I read this as though, having talked about ancient Buddhas and all time, that he looked around the room and saw blank faces. And let's go off on a new tack and say, how do we actually look at time and your own doubt about understanding and time in your life and what I'm talking about here. You take some things for granted, essential things. It's inevitable. But then you can't see yourself living on the basis of assumptions. And you think that because you don't doubt what is here and it's essential and evident, that this is a big problem. We think that because we don't doubt it, we understand it. Oh, this is so. This is my experience right now. Well, whatever my experience right is right now, I'll say, okay, I'm not going to doubt my experience. It's my experience. It's valid. But because I don't doubt it, I think I then understand what's happening. I think I understand my experience and what it says about the world. It's that because I don't doubt it, I think I understand it. It's a big problem. It's kind of the fatal assumption. Assuming that because it looks like that's the way it is, and that therefore I understand. So the taking for granted is very difficult, and yet you can't take it. We can't think about every single thing, and we don't stop and every single time we put our foot down and measure, confer with our foot and our brain as to whether there's something there to put our foot down on. We assume the ground will be there. We assume there'll be a tomorrow when we go to sleep, for the most part. We assume that we will continue. That's a big assumption. I assume that I know what someone else is doing or thinking. I think, assume that I know what I'm thinking. And it's hard when we have to live with a lot of assumptions just to get through life to recognize that they are assumptions and to know that to have assumptions is not the same as understanding. Because assumption means I don't doubt this. The ground is there, I'll take another step. But to think that therefore I understand, it's a big leap. And one of the reasons is that we don't see what we don't see. Another is that if we go around doubting and not understanding all the time, we feel very shaky. And that's not so good. So Dogen says, but then when you do doubt, when you do say, oh, wait a minute, you know, I don't really understand what time is. I don't really understand what it is to be me. I know now that I realize I don't understand this. He says, when we do doubt, we still don't understand. We get tangled up because we don't understand time. And if we don't understand time, we don't understand how our own doubt works in time. That's to say, in being a being who's always changing. Even my doubt's changing, and yet I barely got it. And so it's changing too. How do I live with that? And so then we start to cling to our doubt as though it were a fixed point. The doubt I had 10 years ago may still be something I'm hanging on to now. It's just as some place where we identify with something that we doubt about ourselves or about the world. That's clinging to some idea that a doubt is a fixed thing, unlike the rest of life. My idea of who I am, my persona, my identities, my doubts, I act as though they were outside of time. It's not that whatever happened in the past isn't relevant, but the way we understand it, and the doubt we have about it, and the place we give it in our life, is as though it were a fixed thing, like a suitcase we can bring along with us. And it doesn't work that way. So you sit still in the middle of time. When you're sitting zazen, time doesn't stop. You sit still in the middle of time. You can experience time. You can see that there is this present moment, but there is no fixed past, fixed future, or even a fixed present moment because, oops, it's already the next moment and I'm in a whole different mind state. It's a lot of slowing down to see ourselves living in time and to doubt that we know how to live in time. So it's impossible for doubt to be useful to us when it's a fixed and unchanging thing in a changing world. So yesterday's doubt does not apply well today. The Dogen's saying, doubt, you've generated a nice doubt here about something, and then, whoop, life has moved on. What are you going to do? It's because we don't understand time. We don't understand what it is to be here and how to incorporate what is our relation to what has happened and what we call future. We don't know what that is, and yet we call it future, and we think about it, and we're apprehensive about it, and we're eager for it. We don't know what it is. Huge pile of assumptions about the future. Sometimes it's easier to see the future as full of assumptions because there isn't any real thing, real future. Hasn't happened yet. We're full of ideas about it and assumptions about it that have a big effect on how we relate to it. Is time slipping away from you? Well, that's an assumption. That's one way to relate to time, and it's a very painful way. We all do that. It's very painful. Because we don't understand time and how time seems to move away from us and is it actually coming toward us, because of that, we don't know how to live in this moment in relation to the time, present moment we live in and how that relates to past and future moments. So one thing we can see ourselves doing is taking old doubts and fitting themselves into new situations where they don't really fit, you know, the square peg in the round hole. This is my old how I used to, this is the doubt I used to have, here's the present situation, let me see if I can make them fit. That's suffering. And then old doubts come in and they don't really fit in the present, and yet they don't really, so they don't really disappear into the present, so they kind of pile up. All the old doubts that don't have a way to fit into the present is to know some way to digest, to resolve. This past doubt I had, if it really comes into the present, it will become part of the present and be changed, and something will happen. And the doubts that don't seem to fit, but I think this is, I still have this doubt by God, pile up. They pile up in the corners and they pile up everywhere. And they're indigestible. And then we feel blocked or obstructed or clouded. So then we can say, oh yeah, well, which of us doesn't know feeling obstructed, clouded, and blocked? What if you take that awareness of feeling obstructed, clouded, or blocked and look out from there and say, well, could this be because I have a cockamamie idea about time in which I take some old doubt that I used to have and carry it forward as though it were could sit in a box and then try to plunk it down into this present moment where it doesn't really fit, so all I can do is sit around undigested, blocking and obstructing my view. Or we feel blocked and obstructed because we look back and see some better time. It's the same kind of thing. There's some halcyon day in the past, and I carry that forward and also just doesn't fit in the present moment too well. This present moment is not quite so sweet, lovely. And yet it sits there, and it doesn't have a place to fit, and again, we feel clouded and obstructed. Sometimes we call that regret. So if something from the past comes forward, say something that has changed and was wonderful, or was wonderful then, or really wasn't wonderful then, but it was on its way to being something wonderful, which is usually more really how it was. Usually that past time wasn't exactly so delicious, except that it seemed to be becoming something really good. And so we forget the part that it wasn't really so good, but it was becoming really good, and say, oh, that was so good. different from now, because right now I'm not in this place where I understand myself to be becoming something bigger and more wonderful. So how am I going to really, I'm kind of ignoring that, how things were, that has come forward, it does relate to me now. If I relate to it as in this undigested way, as regret, that was good then, and it has no place in my life now, so my relationship to it is to regret. Of course, this is me tipping over, regretting something, reaching out for in the past, and I'm not in the past, and I'm not in the present either. But if we take that forward, of course, with some recognition that the memory of the past and the doubt of the fear, we're doubting the present, this isn't so good, that was so great. To remember that it wasn't just that it was so great, but that it was part of a process of something. There's a place for it in the present, perhaps, called grief. It's different from regret. The same. There was something that was really fine in the past, or a person in our life, or a time, or a place, or a becoming. That was something that was developing, that isn't no longer developing that way. And somehow, I'm not gonna, if I cut off from it, say it's irrelevant, I'm ignoring that time continues. And the present time is a separate moment from the past, and yet time continues. So I can relate to it as though it's a separate time back there with regret, or I can find some way to make it not an obstruction in the present, but real in the present. Well, that would probably start out as grief. But that's another expression of this is mine, my life today in time. But if I'm going to live in time today, my present moment keeps shifting. The doubt or the feeling or the grief or the wonder that I have in one moment is already, I'm already in a different moment. How will I carry that forward? This is how we live with our own hearts and minds. We are changed, and yet our mind says, oh, there's this thing called the mistake I made or the something bad that happened to me. And I'm going to just carry it forward. And it just obstructs me. And then I have it with me, and I'm going to say, oh, and the same thing is going to, it's going to keep on that way. And then I have apprehension. How will it be in the next moment when I have this undigested block of doubt to carry forward? So since doubt is pretty uncomfortable that way, we sometimes just try to ignore it and say, I want to have a practice that's calm and tranquil and doesn't have doubt in it. But that's leaving out time and the movement of time. Doubt itself is nothing but time, Dogen says. So, this is, you know the Oxfording pictures where first the little Oxforder is looking around for the ox and sees the traces, the footprints. Now, this little guy, or actually I once drew them with a female. This little female herder. How did she already know to be looking? This is the first doubting that my current experience is really, I've got it. Because I know that. My life isn't so completely hunky-dory, so maybe I better do some doubting here. But maybe I can doubt and look, there's something to look for. I see the signs of something that's missing. So we look for the tracks of our own mind state, the footprints of that ox, the ox of the mind that's wandering off rampaging. The footprints that we first see are our own mental states, our feelings, our emotions. My feeling of apprehension, my feeling of regret, my feeling of obstruction. They're very important. Those aren't just problems. Those are the footprints of the ox. So we see this obstructed, apprehensive, regretful. We say, well, could this be the footprints of the ox? Could this be something about a larger story, a larger understanding of my life, not just a muddy obstruction? The Atascadero, our Atascadero Creek, literally means muddy obstruction. But maybe this obstruction isn't just a muddy tangle. Maybe it is a way of seeing something, my mind and something I do in my life and the world I live in and time and how I take place there. In that case, this poor old regret, apprehension, and obstruction start to have a larger role. They're no longer just negative. There's something to look with. You look to see, well, maybe could this be that these states are tracks of my misunderstanding? Does that make sense to me? Can I see it that way? Can I make sense of it? Well, do these states involve clinging? Do they involve time? Do they involve my feeling doubt and incompleteness? Well, yes. And so then we have to do what is counterintuitive and follow the tracks. A little ox herder doesn't get to find the ox unless she follows the tracks around behind the boulders, where she doesn't see a way to go, except that she sees the tracks of her mind and her life. And she and someone else have figured out together that those are footprints of some being that might be an ox, that might be our own mind, and that it might make sense to follow them. Maybe we can follow them together in case the ox has horns. I'll get out my little red flag. As Katagiri says in the book, we have to learn how to question skillfully, not just clinging to the question we have. And he talks in that about this learning how to question what we then cling to. We find something, it feels pretty good, and we cling to it for a while, and then it doesn't work anymore. He tells a story about how he became a monk, when he became a monk, and how really happy he was. And he found something that seemed to really fit his life and make some sense. And then he started to doubt the Dharma and his teacher and his path. He said, what is Buddhism? Why did I become a monk? Why do we have to bow? Why do we have to use chopsticks? This is how he describes it all in his book. It was, why do I have to live this stupid life of getting up early in the temple and it's boring here. He just has young kid, he's basically, I don't know, 18 or so, and he's stuck there in his temple with this old guy and he's just supposed to hang around and do chores all day and get up early and make a fire and food. Yeah, this is a Zen monk life. And then scrub his master's back in the bath at night. And geez, so he doesn't tell it in the book. He ran away. It was such a stupid life that he ran away. He walked all night, slept by the side of the road, and then realized that there he was, still in the middle of his life, with nothing resolved. That there was nowhere to run to. His life didn't become unobstructed by running away and being on the side of the road. He was still obstructed category. He was still confused. He didn't have a clearer sense of what to do. There's no future to be seen just by sitting by the side of the road, not knowing which way to go, and being hungry besides. So when he realized, essentially, that there was nowhere to run to and no other time to run to. You know, when we move somewhere, sometimes there's this wonderful idea that it'll be fresh and clean. And then we discover that we're still there with ourselves when we get there. There's no other time. There's the time right now that you're living, and you're living it. So he went back to the temple. I imagine he thought about running away a few more times, but he didn't do it. left eventually. First he left to go to the monastery, then he went back. Then he felt he wanted to go, but not to escape. He still had the urge to go. So here's, he's moving in time and he wants to go forward in his life. So, but going forward in his life wasn't sitting by the side of the road. It meant going back into his life as it was. But then his life as it was changed. His doubt, what am I doing and why am I doing it here, somewhere didn't go away, but his life changed. And it was time to go to the monastery, and he practiced very hard at Eheji. And then he was studied very hard at Komazawa University, and then he was back at this temple with this guy. And so then he was, there was a possibility to go to Brazil as an overseas missionary to a Japanese-American temple in somewhere in Brazil. A lot of Japanese had gone to Brazil at the time they went to Hawaii, but poor Japanese to work, early 20th century. And his teacher said, no, you belong here. So he sighed and he stayed, and then an opening came up in Los Angeles, and he went to his teacher and he said, can I go? And his teacher, realizing that he wouldn't stop asking, that this doubt wasn't going to go away, said yes. And let him go. So his teacher never didn't have anyone to take over the temple. Every one of his disciples, Kettiger said later, he felt certain sadness that the guy had a number of disciples, and most of them, they went off somewhere else to some other place and did something else. One of them died. One of them went crazy, was in some kind of a hospital or madhouse, and there was Kettiger who just left. And he left his teacher alone, but what he had to do, and the teacher had said, okay, so he left. So his doubt carried, and then he was in this country. He didn't stop having a certain doubt about what he was doing, but he had to find a way to carry it forward. So how he digested the doubt into finding a way to practice in America. Well, then L.A. wasn't so good, because it was really Japan and America. So he went to San Francisco and practiced with, assisted Suzuki Roshi for a couple of years. And then Suzuki Roshi died, and he was leading a group in Monterey area, in Monterey, and that wasn't so stable, and it really was. People came out from Minnesota and said, "Would you come to Minnesota to lead a group? We will support you, more or less." And he and his wife, and I guess both kids were born by then, went out to Minnesota, carrying a certain doubt. But see, then the doubt. Because the doubt is moving through time, with this being and time moving through time, it's a constructive doubt. And I think that's kind of the hallmark of doubt, when it's constructive versus a doubt that we call corrosive doubt. The doubt that it can still be painful, but it carries, it translates into this moment, and to this moment, and into the next moment, and takes a different form in different moments. That's a productive doubt. It carries us. Take that with us, and things open up. And then he started to doubt that. Then he developed a practice where it was sort of a very American. He was sort of anti-Japan for some years, and then he saw that there was something shaky in that. So then he doubted that and turned back toward a more Japanese form of practice, and started encouraging at least his priest to go to Japan and train. And then he saw that actually that wasn't exactly a solution either. Because the person would take the same person they were, go to Japan and train and come back, and they hadn't become someone else, and they hadn't really in some way transformed. Maybe it was too different. Maybe it wasn't the right. No shape of training hadn't worked out so well. A really tight form of training that was maybe too far or away, far in some sense, for people didn't have a transformative element. Then he came, was coming back into, well, what will I? How will the next form of go forward? And then he got cancer and died. So this doubt carried him productively through his whole life. In some sense, boy, it would have been nice to see what the next turning of that would have been. He was only 60, just turned 62 when he died. I'll be 63 in a couple months, in a couple weeks. I beat him out already, you know. And I'm not done doubting. So, you know, now I've grown my hair a little bit. I have enough to yank on. Right. So I think the only thing worse than doubting is not doubting. If it's not doubting, you don't know that you're living by assumptions. You don't know what you don't understand. doubting, either it's obstructed, I doubt everything, and we all have that sometimes, especially at 3 a.m. But there's the other side of doubt where say, I doubt that how I used to think it is really appropriate now, but I doubt that I know what's really appropriate now, but I better keep on figuring it out. Because I am being, I am time, and it is moving. And if we develop what he calls spiritual security or spiritual confidence, it's some kind of confidence that being, I am being, being is, this living is being, this living being is time and is moving, and this is not apart from me. That can help me have a foundation to go on doubting. That's about doubting that I understand so that I can try to understand, so that I can try to meet this moment and make my bring my doubt into shaping my life in this moment. Well, what shall I do now? I doubt that I really got it right, so what shall I do? Or how shall I go about it? It's not necessarily comfortable. Can be not. If it's comfortable or not, it's kind of the scenery of the moment. We like the ones where it's comfortable. We don't like the ones where it's not. But beyond that, this kind of doubt where, as he says, doubt itself is nothing but time, allows doubt to move and change, and then we can say, oh yes, to be human, to be alive, is to be doubting. And that is not a problem. It becomes a problem sometimes, but the fact of doubt as time means it's a natural part of our life. And we will forever be making assumptions because we can't keep track of everything, because we forget that our being is time and our doubt is time. And then we'll have to keep remembering, recollecting that the past moment's doubt doesn't really fit in the present moment, but something is carried forward from it. So what and how will I go forward with this? Doubt itself is nothing but time. That's where Katagiri calls the pivot of nothingness, that we're always at. The past doubt, you can't carry forward as some solid thing. We kind of want to because it's a fixed point, something fixed point of reference, but it's really not conducive to our life because it's not doesn't really fit well. So we have to live at a pivot point of nothingness. This is, say, a pivot point of things are not fixed. Here I am in this present moment. And the only way to settle, to feel tranquil, is to be at the time when I'm able to be here in this present moment, holding, allowing my life to be here with me, not fully understanding it, doubts coming up and down, but here, knowing, participating actively in being time. Our doubt is nothing but time, it means it's always changing. And circumstances are always changing. And you're always changing. We always have to let that in. And yet not lose our balance. That's Zazen is a place for practicing that life of letting in the I'm moving, everything is changing, and yet I'm not knocked over. That's what Katagiri says. You have to swim in the big scale of the world. Life includes my past doubts and not knowing what will come in the future and everything I am now, and it is larger than I know it is. When we live by our assumptions, our world shrinks. That's the price of a kind of security of living by our assumptions. The world shrinks a lot and doesn't really big enough for our life. That's what he means when you have to swim in the big scale of the world. Doubt that says, well, and where will I go next, is part of a large scale of the world. Where will I go next? And what am I now? Oh, I am here. And I'm in some sense this limited, bounded thing. In another sense, the whole world is right here. Life is right here. In the large scale. It always happens simultaneously with the small scale of my body and my achy knees, or the foot that's going to sleep. Questions appear and questions disappear. Doubts and questions. And questions disappearing, we experience as a time of peace and quiet, of not clinging, of everything just as it is, perfect as it is. But that doesn't mean that there's a life of just that, because that would be stopping time. It doesn't happen. And questions appear. And questions should appear. Questions appearing are the time of vow. What way shall I go? Moving forward, meeting the changing aspect. Questions are meeting the changingness aspect of life. What if you take your doubt as a form of vow? To say, oh, I don't understand. I doubt myself. I doubt Dharma. I doubt this practice. I doubt my path. I doubt that my life is satisfying. What if I took, instead of it being some kind of vague and overarching doubt, I said, I doubt that I really know completely the best way to live my life. And I will go forward with that, investigate. It's doubt as vow. For Katagiri, that was this particular form of getting apprenticed into a temple. He'd been ordained and he was obligated to stay there. There's different forms of it for different people at different times. Or the vow to your own practice, say, I'll show up even though it doesn't make sense to me right now. It feels like a very stupid thing to do today. But some other part of me says, A, I doubt that this is my wisdom speaking, or I doubt that I really understand. And instead, I'll take my doubt about what is the right way to go forward as my vow to go forward. It's the doubt that is nothing but time.